I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang of The Daily, and Forbes.com is with me. Steve Herman is the Voice of America bureau chief for North Asia. He is in Seoul reporting now on significant political developments in Japan. Steve was in Fukushima prefecture immediately after the catastrophe, not only of the tsunami and the earthquake. Steve was traveling north on the island all the way to the most devastated cities on the coast. But he was also in the immediate zone outside of. There was some question of whether it was 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers, 50 kilometers. He was close enough so that there was radiation all around him. There are significant statements from the Japanese government tonight about what is to happen to the exclusion zone. Steve, a very good morning to you in Seoul. Can we confirm that the Japanese government is ordering everyone out of the zone, and how big is the zone?
John, what they're doing is they're saying that this 20-kilometer radius around the Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant is now officially off-limits, and violators are subject to the law. It has been technically off-limits for a number of weeks, but there was no way for the police to actually arrest anybody or for the courts to fine anyone. So that's what the Prime Minister has announced on his visit to Fukushima Prefecture today.
So, Steve, are they going to basically send in the troops and forcibly remove these elderly residents? And are we going to see pictures of people screaming and yelling as they're dragged by their hair into police vans?
I highly doubt it. The police have gone around and found, I think it's something like 60 or 70 people that are still living within the zone. The police will go around and perhaps, again, try to persuade these people to leave. But I can't fathom that the military would go in there and forcibly remove people. But that remains to be seen. And we haven't even had an announcement as to what the punishment will actually be for those who are in there. The main problem has been people trying to go back in who left their homes and thought they'd be gone for a day or two and left behind valuable documents or other things. And we met some people when I was there again last week in the zone who were coming back in, going around police roadblocks to get some documents and things like that.
Steve, you've traveled widely in this part of Japan, and I've been following you on Twitter, and I urge everyone to follow Steve. He's reporting in Japan and in Seoul, which will be a hot spot again soon. We can count on that. It's very critical to understand North Asia. But, Steve, first of all, you were in the zone during the times of radiation exposure to everyone. It's gotten worse since then, but Have you had any medical checks that are alarming, or is everything okay with you?
No, everything is okay. I was in Fukushima Prefecture for the first week. I was probably about 35, 40 miles around from Fukushima 1. At that time, in the first couple of days, is when we had the highest releases of radiation, and I certainly was exposed, especially to iodine-131. I was actually drinking water at that time. We had no idea the levels were so high, although that was not a major health risk to somebody of my age. We went all the way to the gate of the Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant last week, and we had dosimeters on us, and the maximum exposure we had inside the zone during the few hours when we went back in for the, it was actually the second time, was only about, if I recall, inside the zone was about 12 or 13 microsieverts. That's a very small level of radiation equivalent to probably being on an airplane for a few hours.
Good. I wanted to make sure everybody knew that Steve was careful, though, you know, at the time we knew, if we'd known then what we know now. Anyway, I want to also speak to the level of devastation. I've seen your tweets about how the cleanup has not started throughout the whole tsunami zone.
Yeah, obviously there was debris that was removed to check for bodies in certain areas, and it's just overwhelming. It was just stunning last week to drive all the way from Iwate Prefecture down into Fukushima Prefecture and just all along that coast, you know, for more than, I don't know what it was, more than 100 miles for sure. Just to see, you know, utter devastation where the tsunami came in, and you know, just imagine if hundreds of towns in the United States along the coast had been wiped out in this manner. Of course, I don't think in the United States that it would be able to be cleaned up after a month.
And no, Katrina,
about years.
6 years later for Katrina. I note also as you move through Honshu, you were always updating us on temblors. You were feeling earthquakes now and again.
Yeah.
And there's recently I've seen a scientific report saying that they're expecting another earthquake of some scale, 7+, to happen soon enough.
Yes. What the most prominent seismologists, some of them in Japan, are, I don't want to use the word predict or forecast, but I guess that's pretty accurate, is that within 6 months of the primary magnitude 9 quake on March 11th, that they expect there will be a magnitude 8 aftershock. And of course, scientists in the field are quite conservative, and so we can imagine they're basing this on what they consider to perhaps be a conservative estimate. So Japan is certainly, based on the predictions of the seismologists, due for a very devastating, potentially very devastating aftershock within a number of months.
So, Steve, how does a government prepare for, you know, they call it an aftershock, but if it occurred anyplace else in the world, it would be called an enormous earthquake.
So, it'll be an aftershock just because it's taking place in the same location or vicinity of the primary quake. But yes, it's like having a ticking time bomb, I guess, from Mother Nature again. Japan has tried its best over the decades and centuries to prepare for these big quakes because it is a seismically active area, and that's why they had spent billions of dollars for many years building these tsunami barriers along the coast. But they were meant perhaps to handle tsunami up to 15 feet. The highest level tsunami we're hearing about that occurred was 40 meters, which is what, about 120 feet or something like that. So I don't know if there's anything man could have built to really have prevented a tsunami coming in. And I heard that it was the force of many hundreds of 747 jetliners slamming into these barriers was the equivalent of force. So the question is, if there is a magnitude 8 aftershock in the same area, will that then generate large tsunami again that would go even farther inland because you have the coast has been destroyed? So presumably areas farther inland where people are living right now are potentially in great danger based on what I've seen.
Let's focus on the nuclear plan and what we know now about this evacuation zone. The government says 6 to 9 months before they get the nuclear plant under control. There are engineering challenges. At this point, does the government have everything it needs, or are they still discovering how bad it is, Steve? What is your measure of the reporting? Because in those early days when I first talked to you, we were getting very iffy reports from the government, and that was part of the problem. We couldn't trust them.
Well, I think there was just tremendous confusion at the beginning because the government was reliant to a great degree on Tokyo Electric Power Company for telling it what was going on. TEPCO didn't have its leadership in place in Tokyo when this began, and there was a lot of confusion and perhaps reluctance to release all the information. I think that we've been getting much better information both from the power company and the government agencies in recent weeks. And there's also, as far as the radiation levels outside the plant, and there have been drones that the United States government has flown over. So I think we've got a pretty good handle on the radiation levels at present. The question still is how badly were these reactors damaged? That's at least a partial meltdown in two or three of the reactors, according to the power company. And there's been some reports that the damage might be more severe. The question really right now is, as long as they are able to maintain the cooling, we don't expect that there's any chance of a full meltdown or recriticality of these exposed fuel rods. But as we were just talking about, if you have another huge earthquake and another tsunami rolling in to Fukushima 1, what could happen? That's the worst case scenario, and it sounds alarmist to talk about that. But of course, no one had ever predicted we would see what happened on March 11th either.
Well, Steve, you know, when you think about this, it must be enormously expensive for Tokyo Electric for this cleanup. Are they going to be financially viable?
It seems that that the government is going to have to get involved in this. There's talk about nationalization of the power company, that the power company might be declared bankrupt and be dismantled. There's a lot of different proposals floating around in Tokyo among the politicians right now. But obviously, Tokyo Electric Power Company is trying to preserve itself as a company, but whether they'll be able to do that, we don't know. Of course, the cost of the cleanup and then all of the liabilities is going to be in many, many billions of dollars, that's for sure.
Fine. This is Steve Herman of the Voice of America. Finally, Steve, your reporting is gritty. When you're driving along in Fukushima Prefecture and you're filing on your tweets, when you hear that, when you feel those temblors and you report them immediately, and then there's a tsunami warning and then it's dropped, at that point, what's it feel like on the road? I mean, what do you think of that? Should you get out of there when you hear a tumbler coming or when you have a tsunami warning?
Well, when you're moving on the road, John, when in the vehicle and it's going down the highway, you don't feel anything. You might notice something if you're aware that there's an earthquake. But when we've had the cars stopped, we've definitely felt them. And then when I was in the town of Namie, inside the exclusion zone, we had a tremendous aftershock, magnitude 6. And there were buildings that had already been damaged by the earthquake, and they were shaking and groaning. And there was a family that ran a pharmacy that came running out. They had gone back in to try to get some medication out of there. And we felt the whole street swaying and the buildings moving around us. It's kind of strange. I've been in a lot of earthquakes, and I don't get really alarmed. When I get excited is when we get these P-wave warnings, which tell us that a quake is imminent. That comes out through the cell phone systems and through the broadcasts, and you just don't know. Is it a false alarm? Is it going to be a small quake or a big one? And I tend to, my heart jumps a little bit when I see those P-wave warnings, because you don't know if you're about to get hit by a magnitude 8 or what. So that's sort of how I react to them. Once they're underway, I've got a pretty good gauge about how big it is and how far away it is, because I've just been through so many earthquakes over many, many years.
Steve Herman, the earthquake whisperer of the Voice of America in North Asia, reporting from Seoul. Right now, the news is the exclusion zone will be enforced by the Japanese authorities, and at the same time, the 8.0 we mentioned, that's just theoretical, it's not a prediction, but it is possible. Gordon Chang of The Daily, Forbes.com, I'm John Batchelor.